from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Thousands take to the streets in downtown Boston as far as the eye can see, holding signs advocating against white supremacy.
President Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, is now out.
If the Secret Service cannot pay these agents for the rest of the year because of this budget over going over the top, what do they do?
Is an admission from him that his instinct was wrong, that he wanted to pull U.S. troops out. That was always what he wanted to do, but that he acceded to the recommendations of his generals, the entire U.S. foreign policy establishment, pretty much.
They're trying to take away our culture. They're trying to take away our history. And our weak leaders, they do it overnight. These things have been there for 150 years, for 100 years. You go back to a university and it's gone. Weak, weak people.
If you'd like to join our conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. As always, I'm joined by some very strong, strong people like Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
And Colin, thank you so much for taking over the last few weeks while I was indisposed. I really do appreciate it.
I think I illustrated your incredible value to the show in my own unique way.
I'm quite sure that the show is wonderful in my absence. I want to also welcome in Keith Faniff, who's our budget guru, the budget Obi-Wan Kenobi, if you will, of the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Keith.
Thanks for having me back.
And Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hello, Daniela.
Hi.
Well, we're going to start with last night's campaign rally in Arizona. And yes, it was a campaign rally less than a year into the Trump presidency. He's had a number of these. It found the president once again speaking directly to his base, hinting at a pardon for criminal sheriff Joe Arpaio, misquoting himself from his post-Charlottesville speech, condemning white nationalists, and of course, going after the media.
Not only does the media give a platform to hate groups, but the media turns a blind eye to the gang violence on our streets, the failures of our public school, the destruction of our wealth at the hands of the terrible, terrible trade deals made by politicians that should have never been allowed to be politicians.
That was Donald Trump as part of a long harangue against the media, something that we've heard before. I don't know, Colin, I listened to it and I thought we really are terrible people. I mean, we're just the worst, the worst kind of people. What was your reaction to the speech last night?
Well, as far as that goes, as our mothers used to say, somebody's going to get hurt pretty soon. And in fact, reporters afterwards were not only being tear gassed as the police outside the arena used tear gas, but people were throwing rocks at them. I think it's Brian Stelter today has a piece that includes a man at the rally with a child on his shoulder, and the man is screaming, "Rat, rat," at the journalists around him. This is something we saw at the rallies during 2016 and 2015, but he's president now, so when the actual president incites, and I would say he's very, very close at moments in that speech to inciting violence against the media. That, you know, that's really, it's, I mean, it was bad enough when a popular candidate did that, but it's kind of scary when the president does that. There were many things that were scary last night about this speech, although in many respects it was a digressive speech with only one theme. This morning I was thinking about a piece that Dahlia Lithwick did in 2012 about order Muppets versus chaos Muppets. So like Kermit and people like him, they're order Muppets, and obviously Animal and a lot of the other really disruptive Muppets are chaos Muppets. And Trump is neither. He's Miss Piggy. He is somebody whose ego and his need for approbation crowds out everything else. And all of what that speech was a speech about Donald Trump. It wasn't really about much of anybody else. The speech, the section about how he's being mistreated by the press, which was this huge advertisement for himself, you know, people timed it different ways, like when that started. It's a 72-minute speech. He spent somewhere between 16 and 25 minutes on that whole question of whether he's being covered correctly by the press. I mean, there's an intelligence to that too, which is if you successfully discredit the press, then every single thing they ever say about you from now on will fall on deaf ears, at least among the people who believed what you said. But everything else there was, in fact, essentially dangled as a way of creating applause. He began the speech by talking about how happy he was to be back there at a place where in the past he's overstated the size of his crowds. He cited crowds that wouldn't fit into that particular venue. He talked about how great it was to be at center stage during the debates. I mean, he kind of relived all the ego massaging moments of the campaign. And then just talked about everything else in terms of how much approval he could get out of it. I can't imagine, or I couldn't have imagined until now, a president using the presidential pardon power as kind of an applause tool. I mean, he was talking about Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and he was saying, do you like Sheriff Joe? And I said, ha, who likes Sheriff Joe? Well, I just want to say Sheriff Joe's going to be okay. He's not going to have any problems. If you know what I mean. It was kind of like, well, that's the presidential pardon power. That's not something that you would necessarily use to court the approval of a crowd. But this whole thing, and forgive me for this particular terminology, but it just seemed like a 72-minute exercise in this discursive public masturbation. It was entirely about the fact that he had been forced by his aides to submerge his ego like a day ago and give a coherent Afghanistan speech, and his revenge was going to be this. He was going to talk about himself for 72 minutes.
And in a moment, we're going to talk about the differences heard in that Afghanistan speech and how, in many ways, the people who he was speaking to last night, the base, didn't like an awful lot about what they heard in that Afghanistan speech. But just back to this point, Colin, about how scared anyone might be about Donald Trump going on as he did last night in a campaign rally. One way to look at it is it's hard to imagine that that's a sitting president doing it. Another way to look at it is, why would we have expected anything different? How is that any different from any other speech that he's ever given? It almost seems as though this isn't a new milestone as much as a continuation of a very, very long theme that started maybe around 2012, 2013, when he started thinking about running for president the first time.
Well, I think you've just summed up one of the jobs of journalism these days, which is at least as directed at the president of the United States, which is this something new, or is this something he's done all the time, or is this some kind of new stretching of a particular mode that he's been in the past? And I would describe last night as that kind of third thing. Yes, it's not as though we never heard any of that stuff, but somehow there was an exaggeration of some of the traits and an elongation of some of the rhetoric. The anti-press rhetoric in particular was heated up to a temperature that I don't think I've heard it, at least not over such a long period of time during his presidency. But I don't know. Maybe it's what I ate or something. Who knows? It struck me as scarier than usual.
Daniela, your response to what you heard last night, also in the context of everything else that's been going on around the nation over the course of this last week, we seem to, throughout the course of the summer, as we know in the news media, we often get to take the summer off, right? It's slow. We don't worry about things. And now every single week is another just torrent of news coming out. Given everything that's happened from Charlottesville on, Barcelona, Steve Bannon, and then you see the president last night, what's your reaction to all this?
I'd like to put out there for Daniela and Keith, there are other ways in which this has not been a summer.
Yeah, which we'll get to in just a little bit of a moment.
Well, you mentioned a campaign rally, but who's he campaigning against? I mean, he barely mentioned, or maybe didn't even mention, the Democrats. He's campaigning against the media, right? I mean, who's his opponent here? It was definitely a campaign rally in terms of the feel and the style of it. But, you know, who was he attacking?
Who he's attacking in part is perhaps ginning up an inside candidate and a challenge to Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator who's gone out against him in a book and on media, including on NPR, going out against, without naming him, John McCain, the other Arizona senator, who famously thumbs downed his health care bill. Yeah. And so in some ways, it's almost as though he's competing against his own party more than anything else.
Yeah, and it's interesting when we use the phrase, you know, the base. I mean, it's not the Republican base. It's the Trump base, but is it even a base? I mean, is it a coherent group of people with a common goal? I don't know. I mean, does this transcend Donald Trump in any way, or is it just about him and, as Colin said, his own ego?
Here's what I don't get. We've had presidents who've had more abrasive relationships with the media right out of the gate. The problem is, and I'm even thinking back as recently as the start of George W. Bush's term, but they reach a point where they say, okay, I've got to have a strategy. It's never going to be a loving relationship, but I've got to live with this. And I don't see Trump having that gear to go into that strategy. Every president has a carrot and a stick. And I think President Trump has a stick, a bigger stick, and a mace. And those are the three choices he seems to have. And he just doesn't have that. So I just wonder, does he really expect he's going to be able to take this approach? Like Colin said, of just you keep discrediting the media for 4 years and it's going to carry.
Well, and as we just said, though, discrediting the media, but discrediting people who disagree with them across the board.
Agreed.
Colin, that means discrediting people in your own party. And it gets back to the little difference between what we saw on Monday night and what we saw on Tuesday. From some of the reporting that we've all read over the course of the last couple of days, it seems as though Trump's advisors had to talk him into giving the speech that he gave on Monday night, which, as you said, sounded like a pretty reasonable, measured response to an ongoing war in Afghanistan. He's long said, as many people on the right and the left have said, that this is not a war that we can continue to put people into, that perhaps we should get out of Afghanistan. That was his position for years. He's not exactly doubling down, but he's adding more troops. To a certain extent, it was like he was listening to some of the people who were in his White House, but he was almost apologizing to the rest of his base, to whom he'd made a pretty strong commitment that foreign excursions and nation building just wasn't going to be the thing under Trump.
Right. And I mean, I do think that there was a psychic cost to him. I mean, internally, like, I don't think he likes doing that. I don't think he likes having they must have just beat him down on this, because, first of all, with Steve Bannon having moved over to Breitbart, he knows where the first and most flame throwing critique is going to come from when he does something like that. And that did happen. I don't think he enjoys anything like that. That process of consultation, that process of maybe being overpowered by facts and details that are effectively marshaled by Madison McMaster and Kelly and whoever else. I don't think that that's fun for him. I think last night was fun for him. I think it's kind of one of the reasons that last night was the way that it was, is because he had to do something that was so out of character the day before. I just want to quickly say a couple of things about the excellent points made by both Keith and Danielle. I think one thing that you were seeing last night was the fusion of a campaign speech, which, as Danielle said, is not really about a specific campaign. It doesn't seem to be about the midterm elections. He'd have much more of substance to say about that, many more targeted words, if it really was, seemed to be as much about 2020 as anything else. But I think it's also, you know, he was introduced where one of his warm-up acts is Ben Carson. There's actually something called the Hatch Act that typically prohibits cabinet officers from engaging in political activities. I don't know if that last night was a violation or not, but you'd have to be able to say what that was last night in order to say it was a Hatch Act violation. What you're seeing there, I think, is the fusion. You see a presidency that's always in campaign mode. Well, most presidencies are always in campaign modes, but this one takes it a little bit further. So what was Ben Carson doing there? You know, what was Donald Trump doing there? What kind of speech was that? And I think the answer is he doesn't want there to be a kind of speech. He wants all of his speeches to be statements about his presidency and campaign speeches and sort of policy addresses all in one. And yeah, I would just, you know, as far as what he's saying about the press, I do feel, what haven't we talked about for about 10 days? Because of Charlottesville and white supremacists and this—
Oh, the Russian investigation.
Yeah, we haven't talked about
I'd
the Russian—
I've forgotten about
I mean,
that.
Robert Mueller has gone out of the news for about 10 days. And so to an extent, by being a chaos muppet, he's created so much chaos that, you know, the thing that he's probably the most worried about has gone away for a while.
I want to go to Bob, who's calling from Goshen. Hi there, Bob. You're on the Wheelhouse.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling about the comment that President Trump made about removing statues of Confederate generals and heroes of the Civil War, because it would result in losing our heritage and forgetting our history and so on and so forth. And I would like to make the point that the erection of the statues was an attempt to erase our history, you know, and rewrite the past. That, I mean, they were celebrating a lost cause that had been settled through the Civil War. And they were put up in, you know, basically, I think, to say, well, we may have lost the war, but we haven't changed our attitudes. These are still our heroes.
And I think, and Bob, thank you very much for your phone call. And I think, Daniela, we all saw some reporting over the course of the last week that showed historically when many of these statues did go up. They went up in the South during the Jim Crow era. They went up during the South again during President Lyndon Johnson's attempt to pass civil rights legislation. And not surprisingly, that's something that an awful lot of people who've been asking for those statues to come down have been citing, that these were put up in a way, much like a rally of Klansmen might, to intimidate people who live nearby.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, and, you know, the message is really clear. And Trump's language that he used, you know, talking about heritage and history and all that, you know, is certainly pretty clear, I think, to most people in terms of what he's what type of a message he's trying to say. This is our country. This is our heritage. And, you know, if you don't agree with that, you know, then you're the problem.
You know, using some of those words, though, I just actually want to quickly turn to something that happened over the weekend, Keith. You know, famously, Big Poppy David Ortiz, the Red Sox star, said, "This is our bleeping city," when he addressed the crowd at Fenway Park following the bombings at the Boston Marathon. Over the weekend, it looked like a whole lot of people in Boston said something very similar to a quote-unquote free speech rally, people who were going to stage a rally that was meant to be somewhat like what happened in Charlottesville. A very small group of ralliers, outnumbered by the tens of thousands by mostly peaceful protesters saying, "Not in my bleeping city."
I think you're going to see that. I go back to the point that was just raised about the Confederate statue, the Confederate flag. And it always drives me crazy when some people will say, "Well, how come we didn't hear complaints about them before? How come they weren't?" And it almost reminds me of the situation with domestic violence. We had a lot of changes in the laws in the 1970s and 1980s that required police to report more, to record more incidents, and to respond to them. So did domestic violence not exist before the 70s and 80s, or was nobody allowed to speak out about it? And I think that's what happened with these statues and with these other things, is that for a long time, as you point out, when they were put out as a form of intimidation, and the people who did speak up were ignored or retaliated against, or they just kept quiet about it. And I think now I'm kind of shifting all this back into what's going on in Boston. We just in society now are not so afraid to speak up. And it's not that this is something new. It's just it's something that's not tolerated in the way it was in the past.
Yeah, interesting, Colin. I just love your take on what happened in Boston, because I think it was not what was expected to happen. The rally that was planned was very much smaller. The number of counter-protesters who came out was very much larger. There was some interesting words coming out of the mayor's office, out of the police commissioner's office as well, that seemed to suggest that type of speech, the hate speech that we saw in Charlotte, is just not welcome in Boston, which is something that's unusual, interesting, and maybe a little different than what we usually hear out of civic leaders, who will at least want to allow people to speak but allow things to be civil whenever there's protests.
Yeah, so a lot of things going on here. Of course, Boston at times has had the opposite reputation, particularly the world of sports. So, I mean, I think there was some corrective measures being taken with some of that rhetoric. You know, that's not really. I mean, Boston has been for forever two different cities, right? Mm-hmm. It is this richly diverse, culturally exciting city full of, you know, very enlightened people. And then somehow or other, there's like, you know, a couple of thousand Irish American meatheads, or whoever they are. I say this as an Irish American, who have given their city this very different reputation, particularly at Fenway Park. So some of that was going on. I will say, in terms of Boston, you know, there was a kind of interesting, this is will only be interesting to a subset of the audience, but there was this interesting kind of these two images that were negative images of each other. We started on Saturday with this overhead shot of this tiny number of guys in a gazebo, you know, and then there's thousands and thousands of people kind of surrounding them, but at a distance, you know. And then 24 hours later on Game of Thrones, you had like these seven guys standing on a rock surrounded by thousands and thousands of people. You're like, how are they ever going to get out of this? The one thing that I will say is, ever since the Trump era began, whenever you want to date that, you know, people say, particularly younger people say, there's never been anything as bad as this. And I always say, well, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71. You know, and America was really in a kind of tumult that featured riots, assassinations, bombings every day for a period of time. You know, there was a kind of danger that I didn't think existed yet in the Trump era. I mean, you know, Kent State, pick your thing. But I think we're getting close. I mean, Charlottesville and then like that rally last night and some of the other stuff that's gone along with it. I mean, even just watching them get out into the Phoenix streets last night, where there was like MSNBC was reporting no tear gas, and CNN had these people, their own correspondents, that were just had tears pouring out of their faces and are choking while they're trying to talk. it's starting to look a little bit more like that era, which really should scare us.
Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about scary. It's the state budget. Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about next with Danielle Altamari, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, Keith Faniff, our budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror, and Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. It's the Weekly News Roundtable, The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Danielle Altamari, State House reporter at the Hartford Current, Keith Faniff, who covers the budget for the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show?
We're working on a show today about cars of the future, and we're getting a little bit away from autonomous cars. What if autonomous cars don't happen? Then what does the future car look like? We're going to give you an update on jetpacks from a guy who's tested a lot of different jetpacks and is still alive. And I think I'm not up to date on the last producing decision about this, but one of the questions that I have, if we do have autonomous cars, they're going to have to make philosophical decisions at times. They're going to have to say, wow, I might have to kill you by running the car into a bridge abutment in order to save four people in front of you. So how will that programming go? There's been a big debate about that, too.
Oh, great. Because the world's not scary enough.
Right.
The Colin McEnroe Show is going to talk about cars making autonomous decisions. That's this afternoon at 1
o'clock. You might get a jetpack sooner than you think, so that's good.
Oh, yeah. Nothing scary about that whatsoever. Let's turn to what's happening at the state capitol. Keith Faniff and Danielle Altamari are there all the time. We still don't have a state budget, and we have, once again, conversations, I guess, between Republican and Democratic leaders. We have the governor throwing some rocks and stones back at Republican leaders and Republican leaders throwing them back. We'll get to that in just a moment. First of all, Keith, I'll ask you first and then go to Daniela. Where are we with the state budget negotiations right now?
Despite everybody's feel-good comments yesterday, we're really not that much closer to where we were a month ago. You could even argue 2 months ago. The governor and the liberal wing of his party are taking small baby steps toward each other, while the Republicans, for the most part, are still on the outside, and it's sort of a fight to see who will get the conservative to moderate Democrats to line up with them. Probably the biggest misunderstanding is what most people don't realize is they're not actually fighting over how much revenue to raise. They're not. They're fighting over what kind. The governor and the liberal Democrats both want about $1 billion a year in new revenue. It's interesting that the way they've messaged it, they've kind of taken that out of the media. But on one side, you've got the governor who wants to send bills to cities and towns. And I'm sorry, folks, but that is revenue. That's not a cut to local aid. He wants to have towns write the state a check for $400 million to help make teacher pension payments. That's no different in concept than if you raise the income tax and you put that money into the teacher pension or you raise the sales tax. And then it'll be the town's problem to figure out how they make those payments. And the other thing the governor wants to do is he wants to expose hospitals to local taxation. So the hospitals will pay $200 million more into the communities. And the governor can, forgive the verb here, launder that money into the state budget by then reducing municipal grants. The liberal Democratic alternative is raise the sales tax, impose surcharges on restaurant and hotel transactions, and use that money to support municipal aid. That's really what the fight is over, two revenue proposals.
So the fight is over revenue proposals, but they're agreed, Daniela, on what the real numbers are, where we need to get to. It's just about how to raise that money?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are also, you know, there are also people over there at the state capitol, the real liberals, talking about still taxing the rich. And, you know, there's still a lot of momentum. Will it get anywhere? You know, who knows? Probably not. But there are still people dug in on that position. So I think Keith's right. It does seem very complex. And despite sort of some of the kumbaya rhetoric of yesterday when there was a meeting and the leaders came out and they all stood together and they all addressed reporters, there does seem to be some real distance between all these different positions at this point.
And the real big difference, right, if you've got not just the liberal wing of the Democratic Party talking about raising taxes on the rich for years and years and years and maybe it's not going to go anywhere this time. The flip side of that is raising sales taxes. Mm-hmm. Raising sales taxes is always seen as a more aggressive way of raising taxes. A more progressive way of doing it is taking it from the very richest people. Where are we with this potential sales tax increase? Because I know a couple of numbers have been floated out there. That's the one that hits everyone's pocketbook, no matter how much money you make.
Yeah, and that's the one that the Democratic leadership is pushing. You know, the governor was asked about it yesterday. He repeated his phrase, and I appreciate Keith sort of breaking it down and saying, you know, when he says we're not going to lead with revenue, that's not really true because his proposal contains all these revenue boosters. But, you know, he was, you know, very dismissive of this idea of raising the sales tax. He was asked if he would veto a budget. He didn't quite answer that clearly, as I recall, but it's it was clear from his comments this is not something he's personally going to champion.
It's been very effective on the part of the administration with the we're not going to lead with revenue to make people believe that this is not another. I mean, don't forget this administration still smarting a little over the fact that look, they had to raise taxes big time in 2011. They had to come back right after winning re-election and promising they weren't going to raise taxes, promising they were going to deliver tax cuts, and come out with another big tax increase in 2015. They don't want to pull off the taxation hat trick. But if you actually go back and look at what they've put together very quickly between various fee increases, income tax credit changes, cigarette and real estate conveyance tax. There's about $350 million in true, according to Hoyle's, tax and fee increases. You've got the $200 million that hospitals would pay by opening them up to local taxation and then again cutting the municipal aid so it benefits the state budget. And $400 million. You do some quick math, that's $950 million a year in revenue. But yet the governor's saying we're not going to lead with revenue. People aren't looking at the details. And John, you mentioned how the sales tax is regressive, and it certainly is. But if you take the assumption that most, if not all, of those teacher pension bills will be met by raising property taxes at the local level, which tax is generally seen as more regressive, the sales or property tax? I mean, that's the interesting thing is the governor who shielded towns in 2011 from local aid cuts because he said this is the most regressive tax, the property tax in the state, is now trying to shift the fastest growing line item in the state budget onto the property tax base, a line item that if the towns kept paying one-third of it, is $400 million now, would go over $2 billion a little over a decade from now. That's the equivalent of putting an entire education cost-sharing program on the property tax base.
You know, I wish we had an intern who had some time to do this, but I'm pretty sure there was like months ago on this show, I asked Keith, what are they really – and Keith, in a kind of wearier tone than he typically adopts, said, well, they're probably going to – and I think what they're going to do is everything that you just said, that you said back then. Because I think you led with sales tax that day. You said
– Did I lead with taxes?
I think you might have said that, probably something with the sales
Somebody
tax.
Somebody has to.
And my guess – I mean, here's where they are to my eyes. I don't have the kind of immersion that Daniela and Keith do. But, I mean, it is sort of like he got – he asked everybody that he knew to empty out their pockets, right? And the pile of money isn't big enough. And so he's looking around now. And there aren't that many places to look. And one of the reasons he's adopted this somewhat combative tone with the towns, which is typically not a good idea. And, you know, his wording, at one point he sort of said, in order to make this, you know, a desirable place to come and live and stuff like that, which – I mean, his wording about towns and cities in the past have been, well, like Bridgeport needs this money. You know, there's like kids who it's different now. He's talking about it in a different way. And I'm not quite sure what that means psychologically. But clearly, he's got to get money. There aren't that many places he can get it from. My guess is that the sales tax is going to go up. It's probably going to go up at that 0.5 rate. And people are going to kick and scream. But I mean, I think you're right, Keith, that to do the other thing, to push it back towards the property tax – I mean, even though politically people might not figure that out or digest it for a year or two until they realize what really happened, that just seems so wrong.
Well, the governor's never really said why he went from, in his first term, being sort of the patron saint of guarding against property tax increases to wanting to make the property tax basically the workhorse to handle Connecticut's unfunded liabilities, its pension debt, for another decade. That's a tremendous shift in policy. And his answer has just been new economic reality, which is not new.
Can I just point out that Bill Curry is the patron saint of guarding against property taxes?
I'll take your word.
The Catholic Church has spoken on that, actually. They are very clear. There was a papal bull.
I mean, Colin's right. His rhetoric, to the town leaders was kind of like, forget it, you guys. You guys have, been held harmless, whatever that phrase means. You've had your budgets protected for a long time. It's not going to happen anymore. We've made the tough changes in the state. You guys need to make the tough changes. Now, some of the towns obviously have done that. Many towns have, struck the kind of agreements with their municipal employees that the state has begun to do with state workers. But there was a real impatience with him, and I don't know if it's just that the towns have been, up at the Capitol too much complaining or what, but he really, didn't you find that, Keith, that he really
right.
seemed to sort of, basically say, quit your whining, municipal leaders.
Right.
There are a lot of needs here in the state, and you guys, have been grown accustomed to having it your way for a long time, and that's not going to be that way anymore.
Where was the economic redistribution of local aid in 2011? There was no effort to shift the money around at that point. And when you look at the places we've hit, I mean, there are income tax increases in the governor's budget. It's just we do them by changing credits for the middle class and the working poor. And that still raises about $150 million. A lot of these, though, are aimed at low-profile things so that it takes out of the history books. That was the third major increase centered on income and sales tax rates. A lot of this looks like it's assembled in ways so that the defining factor was tax increases that don't look like tax increases.
I want to actually get to a point that people who don't watch the Capitol as closely, certainly, as the people in this room do. I don't watch the Capitol anywhere near as closely as Danielle and Keith and Colin do. But I will say that there's another thing at play right now, which is all of the conversations we're having about what's in the governor's budget or a Democratic budget or what the Republicans want to do and negotiating over passing a new state budget, that's happening. And on this kind of parallel track, the state is being run under executive order. And there's this a bit of a dispute between Senate Republican leader Len Fasano, who's been questioning the legality of the governor's executive order, Governor Malloy announcing that towns are getting no funding under the education cost sharing grant, a number of towns. This is a little bit of an interview that Record Journal podcast host Mike Savino had with Governor Malloy talking about Len Fasano, the Senate Republican leader.
I'm amazed when you consider how much cake Len Fasano eats and has too, that he's not heavier than he is. I mean, this is a guy who sits in the cheap seats and throws shots and gets nothing done. Right? Name the last budget he voted for. Republican or Democrat governor, name the last budget he voted for. He hasn't.
Probably before I was governing the Capitol.
Yeah. So, it's real easy to do it. And by the way, why don't you do your job? Why aren't we talking about a bipartisan budget? Get over yourself. Come to the table. He's not. And he hasn't, he pretends he's put a budget on the table that's balanced. It's bogus. It breaks the law. He's saying, well, perhaps the governor is not doing the right thing through executive order. Stop me. Pass a budget.
Well, there's a lot of things to say here. I just on a somewhat lighthearted wouldn't be the right word. But on a whimsical note, right now the Discovery Channel is doing this terrific thing about the hunt for the Unabomber. And one of the ways they caught the Unabomber was that he had used the phrase eat your cake and have it too instead of have your cake and eat it too. And I noticed that Governor Malloy, in a kind of mangled way, does the Unabomber sequence there. So, although he kind of, syntactically, it didn't really flow all that well. But other than that, I just feel like the sniping is incredibly counterproductive. And in a way, this symptom is the disease, right? Why are we where we are right now? Well, because the political numbers got close enough in the two houses, so it was harder to pass a dispositive budget. It was harder to ram something through. The next thing that could have happened would have been the so-called mini budget, a budget that would have at least created some rules for a financial quarter, which I think they should – I said at the time they should do that just for all these nonprofits in the town, just so there can be some rule book for doing all this. So because of that failure, which Len Fasano, who I basically like, and who is, by the way, I believe officially taken himself out of the gubernatorial race in 2018, so that's not what this is. I mean, I'm inclined to believe him. He's still part of this problem, right? He's part of the problem. Malloy's part of the problem. The Democrats in the General Assembly are part of the problem. They haven't been able to collaborate even enough to trickle a little bit of a rule book into this baseball game. So when you hear that kind of sniping and that kind of rhetoric, and there's going to be, well, he started it, and I think all of them just have to get past that. Right now, they deeply need to collaborate. They're in horrible dysfunction, and it's as a result of all of this kind of, you know, nonsense.
Well, and there's two things I'd like our Capitol reporters to comment on. One is the sniping and dysfunction, which is evident there. And the other piece is, what's the impact of running the government under executive order right now and what we're actually seeing? Who is to take what? This is very exciting.
Well, on the executive order, I mean, it's a really a blunt tool that doesn't allow for a lot of, you know, there's no budget, there's no ECS formula, education funding formula, there's no, you know, so there, like Colin said, there's no rule book. So there's certain things the governor can touch, and there's certain things he can't. You know, his aides have pointed out he didn't go the Chris Christie route. He didn't close the beaches. You know, he didn't do a lot of things that other states that have found themselves in similar predicaments, their chief executives have done. But he's only limited to what he can do. And you know, funding for nonprofits is one of the things he could touch. Some of that money he's now proposing will be put back. But, you know, so it's a really sort of a blunt tool that doesn't spread the pain equally. And that's been hard, I think, for people.
I like the idea that Chris Christie is now sort of set a bar for just what type of a government leader you might have. It's like the old Mendoza line, Keith. You know, if you just batting above Mario right. Mendoza 200, you know, I think that this is Chris Christie. Anything better than Chris Christie is just fine.
Or if you're a better son than the Mendoza brothers, I think, you know.
Oh, jeez. I can't. I got to go. I can't top any of that. On the executive order, one, I will just say, I mean, that is a thankless job. I was trying to find an analogy. I couldn't come up with one. I said maybe, you know, Jack Nicholson at the end of A Few Good Men. But if he had never ordered the code red, he's just like, why are you questioning me? The governor has to try to spread way too little butter over way too much bread. I mean, this is a budget that if you ran it under last year's programs would run anywhere from 1.6 to $2.3 billion in the red. So there's no way you can do this by executive order and not tick off everybody. That's the first point. Secondly, why, Collins, you know, why wasn't there a mini budget? That was kind of lost. The main reason was, and this will give people a clue as to when we're finally going to see an end to this mess, the House Democrats did not want to give the governor the tremendous political leverage in the budget debate he would get if there was a mini budget. Because on October 1, we drop off a cliff. So they knew if we had a mini budget for the first 3 months of the year, July, August, and September, and things went well, the closer we got to October 1, the governor, they felt, could dictate the terms of a budget debate, the new budget. And that's where I'm going with this. So far, just through July and August, cities and towns have gotten about $110 million less in local aid than they got in 2016 in July and August. Local aid is not distributed equally all year. There's a big chunk that goes out in the fall. The stakes changed dramatically by October 1. That $110 million less will go to $540 million less. Communities that have reserves will be tapping them. Those that don't will be borrowing or issuing supplemental tax bills if they have the nerve to order more property tax increases in a municipal election season. In other words, the manure hits the fan big time in about 5 weeks. And I don't think anybody wants the budget debate going. And that's when you see people bending, cracking, compromising.
I just have to, before we take a break, I just want to say we got an email from Jonathan and we got a tweet from Neil. And they basically say the same thing. Why are we just talking about sales and property taxes? Electronic tolls could provide $1 billion in revenue next year without affecting traffic. I don't know if that number's right, but we take Jonathan's point. And also with Massachusetts being so slow to create the infrastructure for legal marijuana, we could actually get ahead of them. This is something we hear often, Daniela, in a year in which it would seem that everything is on the table, including structurally renegotiating the way we provide aid to cities and towns, raising the sales tax, and probably, as Keith said, laundering money through property taxes. we're not talking about raising money through tolls anytime soon. We're not talking about raising money through marijuana.
Well, we may not be talking about it right here at this moment, but certainly there are, again, the liberal faction, in especially in the House Democrats, the sort of left side of that caucus is definitely talking about those things, especially marijuana. They've been talking about it for, you know, years now and are continuing to talk about it. That's, you know, how soon that money will come in. Who knows? They, you know, initially the estimates were extremely rosy and probably not accurate, but it's an untapped pool of money that people see.
A best case reality check, Keith, on both things, right? So if people say we can raise taxes by legalizing marijuana, we can raise taxes by putting tolls up. I mean, what are the numbers actually look like and when?
Marijuana, you're probably looking at 100 million, maybe 150. I don't think best case, you're going to see that probably very likely after the election. Same thing with tolls. Not that much of a rush on tolls, but there's probably a 2 to 3 year ramp up on those. All that money would go into the transportation fund. All of that will absolutely have to come after the election because our debt costs explode again. None of what we're talking about now stabilizes anything. And whoever the next governor is has to deal with a big problem. We'll be doing this every 2 years through the early 2030s.
Right. First of all, I'd just say I looked it up with the Menendez brothers. So my apologies to any brothers named Mendoza.
Lyle and Eric are forgiving.
So I think these are two different things, and I think it's a mistake to lump them in together. To me, the toll thing is kind of a no-brainer. We should do it. Keith's right, though. This is sort of a bigger version of the patches that we do, right? It isn't the structural fix that we'll probably never get. But it's a big patch as opposed to a little patch. It's a new stream of revenue, and it's probably significant. We should have done it. I think it's irresponsible of them not to have done it. I also think it would be irresponsible, kind of borderline immoral, to do marijuana strictly as a revenue measure. Marijuana is a big policy change. There's a lot of things to go with it, the area of law enforcement, public health questions. There's a lot of things that need to be answered about marijuana. And you don't make that change just to get the money. You make that change ultimately because you've looked at all those variables and you've decided it's a net plus to do it this way. Not just in money, but in terms of the good of the society. This is not a decision you make about money.
Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Faniff is the budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Danielle Altomare covers the State House for the Hartford Current. We're going to come back in just a moment here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror, Danielle Altomare from the Hartford Current. We were talking about what's happening or not happening at the state capitol. Of course, during a year in which there's a very difficult budget battle going on, maybe some of the politics of who's going to be the next governor get put aside. We heard that Denise Merrill, somewhat surprisingly, I suppose, to some, said that she's going to run once again for her role as Secretary of State. I don't know, Keith and Danielle, what are we hearing out of the state capitol in terms of all of these candidates who've lined up saying, I want to be governor or I want to have some statewide office right now? It does seem to be pretty quiet.
I think part of the reason it's quiet is because there really isn't much you can say that's positive. At least if you're going to weigh in on the big news of the day on the budget. I mean, Mark Boughton made a statement that he thought he could phase out get rid of the state income tax. It got a little bit of attention because if you had to read the fine print, he said he could do it over 10 years. That still wouldn't be enough time. You know, he certainly hasn't laid out any plan to do it. Nobody wants to weigh in because if they do, basically they have to be ready to answer the question, what are you going to do over the next decade and a half when, you know, Connecticut's problem gets 3-4 times worse than it is now?
Daniela?
Yeah, and why would you possibly want that job? I mean, that's really what, you know, all of us should be asking them. I mean, it's talk about tough decisions, as Keith just laid out. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be hell in a lot of ways. But yeah. Many people want it. So
many people want it, but it's interesting. I suppose that now when you have the sniping back and forth, Colin, maybe people want to lay out of this, but it's also maybe a time to actually make some policy proposals, to actually say, hey, if I was there, here's what I do.
Oh, why start now? yeah, I mean, I that's one of the reasons I believe Lynn Fasano when he says he's not a candidate in 2018. I think he knows it's a bad job. I think policy proposals, I think it's early for there to be policy proposals. I think right now there's a lot of jockeying for position and raising money. One of the things that I'm going to watch this time that intrigues me, now that we've settled into the so-called citizen election program, one of the things that I think is different is, you know, there's a lot of people who are sort of, you know, trial ballooning governor's races. In the past, they've done – many of them have done that with the idea of negotiating maybe at the time of convention for some other spot on the ticket. If Kevin Lembo runs, for example, there will be a new comptroller of Connecticut. And I think that that's less likely now. I don't know what the other panelists think. I think that's going to be less of a trope these days simply because you have to raise so much money to be in the conversation. In other words, to qualify for CEP, you have to do so much work. So to qualify for CEP at the gubernatorial level, by the time you've done that, I don't think you're in any frame of mind to say, well, what I really want to be is comptroller, or I'd love to be your running mate as lieutenant governor. I mean, you just killed yourself getting that money. That money is not easy to raise. Everybody finds it hard. So I sort of assume that anybody who says they're running for governor right now, they really mean it, because you wouldn't do this if you didn't.
And I still say don't rule out some people who will be running more than just a gadfly-type campaign who opt not to take public money. I think there are some people – I'm not saying that necessarily that strategy is going to pay off, but I think some people are going to look at how difficult it is. I mean, Mark Boughton couldn't make the cut the last time. He wasn't able to raise enough in his bid for governor 4 years ago. I think a lot of people are going to consider trying it without the public money.
I think you're right. I think you're right that they'll at least look at it. The question is, what do your donors, your potential donors outside the CEP say to you? Because you go to them and say, you know, I'm not going to do this thing. And they go, really? So we have to give you money because you won't do this thing where you just get the money? It's a harder sell to a donor, I think.
Well, of course, and there's at least one would-be candidate who wants to raise the money through the CEP, having a little trouble getting it through the courts. Joe Ganim, the mayor of Bridgeport, is still thinking about this, but I think is facing a little bit of a court battle. One of the things that was what was interesting, as I mentioned, Denise Merrill deciding she is going to run for another term as Secretary of the State. Matt Lesser, who is a Democratic representative, had sort of put himself out there as someone who is angling for that position. And it's sort of this awkward point now where I suppose he has to go back into the shadows.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, there's always that dance. You know, we're all sort of still waiting to see what Lieutenant Governor Nancy Wyman will do, if she is going to run or not. I think most people are thinking she probably won't, but we don't really know. And it is getting late. And there are a lot of Democrats in the field who have said if she runs, they won't. Jonathan Harris, Kevin Lembo. I mean, there are a bunch of people who just, you know, will step aside. So it does create this sort of awkward situation.
And you know, everything goes back to the budget. In 2 months, we're going to test the revenues again. And do not rule out the possibility that in November, things could get worse. That could, you know, if something needs to, you know, help the lieutenant governor make up her mind or someone else who's on the fence, it might be just going back to what Daniela said. Why do I really want to do this?
The night is dark and full of terrors.
One of the terrors is the Secretary of State primary. Those of us who survived the Bisowitz-Skalatar primary never want to see that happen again. However, there wasn't a sitting Secretary of State at the time. So I think that's not going to happen this time. There actually is somebody, some woman in Woodbridge, who I think is declared for Secretary of State.
But I just want to leave our program with this, Colin, you know, with about a minute and a half left. There's always been this sort of weird tension between what we call the Trump base, people who are widely seen as, you know, sort of white working class folks who feel as though they're not getting a fair shake, and the fact that Trump himself and many of the people who he surrounds himself with embody a sort of lifestyles of the rich and famous lifestyle. What happened this week with Louise Linton, the wife of Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, sort of points to that tension, I would think.
She Instagrammed a picture of herself getting off a plane. She kind of tagged the items in her outfit, with what designers they came from. There was some pushback on Instagram, some comments talking about basically – and Louise Linton, just to sort of put her in perspective, is sort of a grade C Scottish actress who now probably is famous enough to be in a Sharknado movie at some point and probably will be, but wasn't before this. And it's kind of a Marie Antoinette moment. I mean, she really did kind of spit on these people who were criticizing her, saying that they just really weren't rich enough to be in a position to contribute to the government in a way that would enable them to legitimately criticize her. Another moment of tone deafness.
In a week full of ugly things, it was one of the uglier ones. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thank you.
Thanks to Keith Faniff, who covers the budget for the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
And thanks to Daniela Altamari, who covers the State House for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Daniela.
Thanks.
Thanks to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, to Katie Talarski and Kion Wolf for producing our program today. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse.